If after hearing what I'm about to reveal in this episode, you keep entertaining the lie we get told about Bouhmara's rebellion against the Moroccan government during the early 20th century being confined to a local uprising, then my friend, I don't know what to say to you anymore. You're in for an awakening because at some point in this episode, you should hopefully come to the understanding that Bouhmara's case was part of a complex network of geopolitical intrigue and colonial ambition. Hi, my name is Aya. Welcome back to Land of Mankind, the podcast where I tell you the stories of those who made Moroccan history for better or for worse. Let's pick up where we left off, shall we? After a lot of back and forth between cities, Bouhmara's headquarters were set in Tezda, where, like we mentioned, he was growing more and more influential, even being mentioned in Friday sermons and prayers, which led the governor of Tezda, an agent of the Mkhzen quite naturally, to write to the Sultan's administration out of worry, and I quote what he said. If the Sultan continues towards Marrakesh, Bouhmara will take Fez without any difficulty, perhaps without even firing a single shot. Prayers are being offered in his name in the mosque of Tezda. After being humiliated on the battlefield by Bouhmara's forces on numerous occasions, Sultan Moulay Abdelaziz finally decided to try out a different approach. Since his rebellion was entirely built on a total scam, on the most outrageous lies there is, he figured the best way to end it might be to shed light on the truth, to expose it. The truth being that the real Moulay Mohammed, remember, the Sultan's older brother, was being held in the prison of Meknes. So Moulay Abdelaziz thought that if he freed his brother and showed him to the word, it would resort to cutting off Bouhmara's support system. The plan was to say, look, here is the real Moulay Mohammed, guys. Don't listen to that stupid con artist who's attracting you problems with me and the central government. He's lying to all of you. And while this could have seemed like the best way out, things didn't exactly go as planned. Bouhmara's allies didn't budge on their faith in him. Those who weren't aware of the scam were chronically convinced that Bouhmara was who he said he was, the genuine Moulay Mohammed. How could the Sultan expect them to take him to his word? They had no reason to trust him. First of all, most of them weren't his biggest fans, and that is an understatement. Secondly, how could they be sure that the Moulay Mohammed the Sultan presented wasn't just another con artist chosen by him to impersonate his brother and discredit their ally? Tricky. Very tricky. A slippery slope, to say the least. In January 1903, a new minister of war was appointed by Sultan Moulay Abdelaziz. From there, things started taking a very different turn at last. The new minister went by the name Al-Minhibi. His mission was clear. He had to bring Bouhmara to the palace, alive or dead. Either way, after all the turmoil he caused them, the Mkhzen wasn't planning on sparing him if they were to catch him. Al-Minhibi launched yet another military campaign against Bouhmara's forces, but this time he achieved the Sultan's first victory. The central government was beginning to see the light at the end of the tunnel. The successes of Al-Minhibi took a real toll on the confidence of Bouhmara, who had been accustomed to less resistance. Our imposter ended up being driven away from his headquarters in Tezda. In short, he escaped. Bouhmara led his troops to the far northeast of Morocco and found refuge in the Qasba of Silwan, not too far from Nador. Bouhmara bounced right back in again and held his ground for nearly 6 long years after being driven from Tezda. And what is key here is that this extreme, almost absurd endurance and his ability to uphold the Mkhzen's attacks for such an extended period of time strongly depended on international support. First things first, the French. Because yes, at the heart of his military strategy was the use of modern French weapons that were fueling the rebel troops. It gave his forces a superiority over the soldiers of the Sultan, who were more traditionally armed, at least in the early stages of the conflict. French support, particularly in the form of weaponry, raised suspicions about the depth of foreign involvement and their hidden agendas, because they most certainly didn't get involved out of inclination and favoritism for Buhmara. Not at all. The rebellion was part of a much larger geopolitical game. For France, supporting Buhmara meant extending French influence in North Africa by backing a rebellious dissident entity against the central Moroccan government, who, for the record, still hadn't fully transmuted into France's puppy yet. But French support didn't just stop at weapons. No. It extended to finances, financial backing from authorities next door in French Algeria. This financial assistance allowed Buhmara to maintain his forces, to buy more and more supplies, to secure the loyalty of various tribal allies who felt emboldened by the look of such an equipped leader. For the French, it was a strategic investment they were making there. They had the opportunity to weaken the central government of Morocco, which, sure, they had relations with, but wouldn't mind taking down if that meant making it easier for them to exert influence over the country's affairs and to pave the way for future colonial expansion. You see where I'm getting? I hope you do. 'Cause we are not done, most certainly not. Buhmara's surprising ties with France weren't just a matter of political strategy, but the whole thing was based on a pragmatic contract with practical terms. In exchange for French support, Buhmara would reciprocate by allowing French interests to exploit the resources of northeastern Morocco, a region which he controlled. He was willing to ally with foreign powers, even at the cost of granting them access to Moroccan land and Moroccan resources, particularly minerals, which the French were on the hunt for. As a result of those agreements, French companies got the right to exploit and explore minerals which were vital for Europe's industrial expansion. They had their own commercial interests and they were willing to do whatever it took to facilitate them. But Buhmara saw these concessions he was making as a necessary compromise to continue to challenge the Sultan's rule. But clearly, at one point, Buhmara figured French support just wasn't enough on its own. So he also sought backing from Spain. He approached Spanish authorities in Melilla. Melilla, an enclave which was then only controlled by the Spanish and that is located on the Moroccan coast. It was one of the most strategic and popular entry points of European influence in the region. So by engaging in negotiations with Spain, Buhmara hoped he could leverage the rivalry between the two European powers for his own benefit. And if he could do that, he could sustain a double-sourced flow of weapons, money, and political backing pouring from both sides. He used these negotiations to his advantage, playing one power against the other to secure greater benefits for his cause while maintaining his own. These agreements between Buhmara and Spain led to the establishment of a company, the Spanish Company for Rural Metals, which gave Spain access to our mineral wealth in the eras that were under Buhmara's control. For Spain, it provided economic gains and increased influence in Moroccan affairs. While for our guy, which, you know, he isn't our guy, but you get me, it meant a steady source of revenue and maybe even a glimpse of hope for more legitimacy in the international scene in the future was his rebellion to succeed. Beyond military power and strong economic alliances, Buhmara wanted to create a political structure that could rival the Sultan's authority. That was the whole point, to overthrow the Sultan. And what does a political structure require? I give you 2 minutes. Actually, less than that, 5 seconds. Yes, a central authority. Buhmara established a government in a very strategic location, Silwan. For those of you who might be, you know, unfamiliar with Moroccan cities, Silouane is a small town not too far from Nador, which you might have heard of if you've ever been to Morocco, and that is located in the Rif region. Remember, the Rif was the beating heart of Bouhmara's rebellion. He even appointed a prime minister, whom I couldn't find the name of, but you get the point. That entire structure and his deep-rooted alliances meant that Bouhmara could effectively govern these territories that were under his control, in the eyes of his allies, his supporters, but also of potential neutral parties. Putting up an organized front like he did made the rebellion more appealing. It gave it more credit. Forming a government, Bouhmara was signaling that this little chaos he had started, well, get up to speed, everyone. Look how it's evolved from a mere insurrection into a full-on alternative state with its own administration, complete with the implementation of laws, tax collection, and effective strategies to maintain order. Let's go back to the French for a second. They were not just passive in their support, as one could imagine. No. Reports show that the French had actively been encouraging Bouhmara's alliances with local tribes. The French recognized, probably even more than Bouhmara did, that a unified front would be more effective in challenging the Sultan's authority. And they had to make sure that were they to support, it better at least work. So, French agents provided resources and diplomatic support to strengthen these alliances between tribes. It allowed the French to protect their strategy in North Africa, and Bouhmara to have a growing supply for fighters, potential spies, and resources. But why put all your eggs in one basket when you've got so many to choose from? With that mentality, aside from France and Spain, Bouhmara also relied on yet another means to maintain strength military-wise, less formal this time. And yes, you saw it coming. He acquired illegal weapons through an agency called the Mohammedia Agency. These weapons, being illegal, meant that they were smuggled through large networks which, as we've mentioned previously in the series if you paid attention, were anchored in North Africa and had already been challenging the authority of the Mkhzin. Now, I do realize that my wording of how things went down may have made it sound bigger than it was, because bear in mind that in actuality, these alliances with European powers were short-lived. At a certain point in time, these agreements between the rebellious factions and European powers broke down for a lot of different reasons. The number one being that tables of power were simply turning, as they do so well. The political landscape in Morocco was changing a lot. Colonial France and Spain were getting very tunnel vision on Morocco, and both countries were balancing their own relations with the Sultan's government. These first few years at the doorstep of the 20th century can be seen as phase two of the prelude to the establishment of the protectorates over Morocco in 1912. Does that make sense? Precisely because alliances and political interests usually move as one, once again the tables had to turn. And as they did, tensions grew. Something absolutely needs to be said about Bouhmara's increasingly erratic behavior. His ambitions were already making him a bit of an outcast, to say the least, but his actions made him seem out of control. Matter of fact, scratch that, he was out of control, and Europeans simply couldn't put up with it anymore. They knew they would have it easier with the Sultan, who was more laid back, less attached to any sort of ambition, really, more willing to be controlled, go with the flow of European interests, less assertive, and also less troublesome, as the rebellion was indeed spilling a lot of blood. The end of this agreement was a turning point for Bouhmara, as it meant cutting off his supply chain in more than a half. However, soon enough, that early choice the French had made to help Bouhmara sustain his insurrection, well, it came back to bite them in the butt. because the agenda of the colonial forces got a bit blurred as it came to light that despite their withdrawal from their agreement with the rebels, Buhmara still had many supporters within the French military, soldiers that were sold on his conception of Morocco, or should I say French interests, on what it was entailing for colonial France in the future. For a few weeks there, significant means had to be deployed in order to unify the ranks within the military. While some factions of the military saw Buhmara as a tool France could use to undermine the Sultan, as we've mentioned earlier, others view his growing power as a threat to French interests. And in a minor but surprising turn of events, French forces resorted to bombarding some positions that were held by their own soldiers who were pro-Buhmara supporters. They were bombing each other. Why, like I said, it didn't last long or anything, but still, the French forces had to make a move to reassert control over these rogue elements, so to speak, of the military who were misaligned with the mainstream strategy. The mainstream strategy essentially consisting in cutting off Buhmara and cancelling him altogether. When things soured between him and the French, like we just described, Buhmara turned to Spain for support, which was to be expected. Specifically, he engaged with a major Spanish military figure in the region, General Marina. The new talks they were having promised economic cooperation and possibly some military help against the Sultan's forces, which kept Buhmara in the game. He especially found his ease on the Spanish side of colonialism in Morocco and continued to rely on his partnership with them. Buhmara signed yet another trade agreement that was centered on Lidia, which allowed him to access European markets. In return, the deal would allow Spain to further extend its influence over northeastern Morocco. So the clashes kept on going for a while, but ultimately, as the conflict escalated, Spain kind of chiseled out as well, following the French footsteps. General Marina was sending reports to Madrid about the growing anti-Buhmara sentiment in the region and how they were probably gonna need to seek new alternatives, new strategies to safeguard Spain's interests in Morocco. To reassess its support of Buhmara, the royal army started marching into northeastern Morocco with a force that had not been seen in years, and Spain feared the risks of becoming entangled in a conflict that would compromise its colonial plans for Morocco. So it simply decided to withdraw, to cut off Buhmara as well, and to declare neutrality in the conflict. Historian Muhammad bin Azuz al-Hakim had an interesting perspective about the Spanish support for Buhmara that I thought I'd share with you. He saw it as a part of a bigger, broader European strategy in North Africa rather than just a straightforward alliance. According to him, Spain was more about seizing opportunities than it was about sticking to a certain ideology. In one word, it was purely opportunistic. It wanted to balance out French ambitions while also grabbing a slice of the economic pie in Morocco. The royal army began to march into northeastern Morocco with a force that had not been seen in years, and as it did, the pressure on Buhmara grew. His strategy of relying on Spanish support against the Sultan started to backfire completely. General Marina and his troops were becoming worried about their economic interests, as we've mentioned. But the real turning point came with Sultan Abdul Hafid, not only for Buhmara's rebellion, but for the entire country, as we'll cover in upcoming episodes. As you've probably picked up on by now, Moulay Abdel Hafid rose to power during a chaotic time in Morocco. He created the Hafdiya movement, which was essentially the expression of the opposition to Sultan Moulay Abdelaziz. As the Khalifa of Marrakesh, he received backing from figures that were very influential, like the Jewish merchant Joshua Korkos and a rather powerful German company. He called for a jihad, a war, to remove his brother Moulay Abdelaziz, who, as we covered in previous parts of this series, was seen as weak. In March 1907, after Émile Mauchamp, a French doctor, was killed by some Moroccan armed groups, the French decided to retaliate, and their head of state ordered General Lyauté to march on Oujda. As we saw previously, if you remember, Oujda had been in a state of chronic instability for years prior, with both local leaders and foreign powers seeking to exploit it, which set the stage for the French intervention. They took the city without a fight, making Moulay Blaise's look even worse. And it was in the middle of all of that that religious leaders in Marrakech named Moulay Abdelhafid as the new sultan and decided to replace Moulay Blaise with him once and for all. Even though the latter tried to fight back with a religious ruling against his brother, Abdelhafid stuck it out and pressed on. And by January 1908, he officially became sultan. And one thing Abdelhafid wasn't happy about was the image Bouhmara's rebellion had projected onto the Alawi name. He was determined to bring order back to the kingdom, quote-unquote order, and to reassert the authority of the sultanate, a determination he seemed to have lost when came the time to hold Morocco's ground against Europe and not to have it surrender to colonial rule. But anyways, that's a different story. The support Abdelhafid gathered was coming from factions that were fed up with the perceived weakness of his brother. And for Bouhmara, it was kind of the beginning of the end, so to speak. The new sultan's way of approaching the conflict, of running the country, of approaching governance, weakened his rebellion. It reduced Bouhmara's position both politically and militarily. Abdelhafid quickly did what his brother couldn't do. He earned back the loyalty of some tribes and military leaders who had grown disillusioned under his brother's rule. Not because he was a better sultan than Moulay Abdelaziz, far from that, but simply because he was new, embodied a new, fresh start. Moulay Abdelhafid presented himself as a stable and capable ruler, and he used that marketing strategy, so to speak, to sway groups that had previously supported Bouhmara, undermining his power base. And as the legitimacy of Abdelhafid grew, Bouhmara found himself increasingly isolated, his momentum fading, and his support base crumbling. Adding to the troubles Bouhmara had to face, Sherif Emzian enters the chat. Emzian was a powerful tribal leader in the Rif region, and it just so happens that he didn't like what Bouhmara was doing in the region. So Emzian declared war against him. And in response to this open challenge, Bouhmara had to launch several military campaigns to regain control over the Rif region through direct confrontations, but also through attempts to negotiate his way back to the tribe's hearts, so to speak. But the conflict continued to stretch his resources thin. It distracted him from his main goal, which used to be the central government, and so it weakened his position. The end was near. Some tribes started to switch sides and secretly pledge allegiance to Moulay Abdelhafid. It was a pragmatic decision. Tribal leaders had to resort to align with the emerging authority if they wanted to secure their safety, their autonomy, etc. And the chances of Bouhmara winning were so small, growing even smaller when he got deprived from a unified tribal base. This realignment of alliances also provided Abdelhafid with so much valuable information on Bouhmara that he was able to collect and to use against him. All while this was happening, Emzian was able to successfully unite about 15 tribes, which is huge, into a coalition against Bouhmara. They coordinated their resources, their military, local knowledge, and together they marched on Silwan, Bouhmara's headquarters, to cut off his access to supplies and reinforcements. The siege was a catastrophe. It put so much pressure on Bouhmara's shoulders and on his followers. They had to make several desperate attempts to lift the siege of Silwan in response, and God did they try. They tried so hard, but Emzian's forces were well prepared and managed to counter these attacks. it failed completely. And as the siege dragged on, conditions within Silouan were deteriorating. Soldiers were suffering from food shortages and medicine shortages as well. Quite expectedly, I am afraid, the hardships of the siege, combined with the apparent uselessness of their resistance, led some of his followers to question Buhmara's ability to carry on this project of his. Rumors started spreading, rumors of people deceiving Buhmara and secretly negotiating with the representatives of Sultan Mulay Abdul Hafid. This created a lingering atmosphere of suspicion, of paranoia, which affected the discipline of Buhmara's forces, an atmosphere Mulay Abdul Hafid started to capitalize on even more by literally offering amnesty to Buhmara's followers. He gave, on paper, his followers an opportunity to abandon him, to cut him off, without any fear of retribution. And my oh my, did people run back to the Sultan. Could you blame them? Could you? Buhmara wasn't the most sympathetic leader either. People were pissed off by the intrigue he had created, by this whole mess, and he became more and more isolated. Buhmara had to make himself small for a while. His forces depleted, his support crumbled. But Buhmara still took one last chance in Tanja. He continued to urge his followers to resist, promising them that it was just a hard time to pass, that if they held on for just a little longer, victory was possible. And so they did, for a while. But once the mighty rebel leader found himself completely cornered, overwhelmed by the odds, outnumbered, cut off from any potential reinforcements, it was over. That was it. Years of political greed that got translated into a rebellion that led him to challenge the Mkhzin at every turn. Years of manipulation. All of that for what? To come to an end in Tanja. Ultimately, Buhmara, or should I say Jilali, now that the masquerade was over, was captured along with his last few 400 followers. The rebels were taken to Fez, the capital of the Mkhzin, which was very symbolic. But only about 160 people would make it there alive. He was dragged in a cage in public for people to see and executed in September 1909. Some people, including some French journalists, which are not so unbiased if you ask me, described a version of his death straight out of a horror movie. He would have been dismembered, while others claim he was shot in cold blood and then buried in a mass grave. We will never know.